And welcome back to Coast. This hour, it's the interactive portion of the program. We'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Ronaldo Brudoco with us. His work, Freedom from Middle East Oil, His website, worldbusiness.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Ronaldo, with all these things that are happening and people are being bombarded with just about every news item you can, at what point do people just simply crack and say enough is enough?
I think we passed that point, don't you?
I feel it sometimes.
Yeah, it seems to me that one of the reasons I launched Optimist Daily, which again is a free service, and I'm doing it because it's in my interest to have more people start their day with the antidote to cynicism and pessimism. If you really don't think you can do anything to create a better tomorrow for yourself, it's pretty depressing. And I think there's a collective malaise in our society.
Yep.
In fact, it's probably global at this point. And I think we need to snap out of it. And so my contribution to that was to fund this company so it would be able to create a few minutes of positive thinking, so optimism being the antidote to cynicism. You give yourself a couple minutes of positive stories in the morning. It's amazing how that can help you change your attitude about the whole day. I mean, like, if I look at today's, for example, we did a leading story on females who are upending business in 10 separate male-dominated industries. We did a story on the first hybrid cruise ship, which is being launched. We just did a story this morning on a new blood test that can detect 20 different types of cancer in one test.
That's amazing.
We did a story on Mattel's colorful game Uno getting an inclusivity upgrade. So a variety of stories. A smart filter supplies your home with unlimited mineral water. I mean, a variety of stories that have a basis in stuff that if you think about it, goes, oh, gee, that's really good. So that's positive. And then you go look at the next question that comes in front of you, and you go, well, what would be the positive outcome to that? Can't we have a positive outcome? Why can't we have a positive outcome? Gee, if I don't like the life I've got, the way I change that is to create the life I want, not to settle for the life I've got. And I believe that's where the change will come, and I think it will come. I think people have been caught in this malaise long enough that they're now ready to break out of it, and I certainly hope they do, and I believe they will, and I'd like Optimist Daily to be a way that people can do that at no cost.
Well, good for you. And again, how do they get it?
It's free. Just go to optimistdaily.com, and we'll send it to you every day, 2 minutes to read it, and you'll start seeing all these different stories, everything from, you know, breakthroughs in electric vehicles to health and wellness techniques you can use to reduce your blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. And there's all kinds of different ways. There's 17 categories of stories, and we try to mix them up so that there's something for everybody in there. And in fact, the way we choose the stories every day is we try to make sure that we hit at least two or three different categories of stories for people with two or three different kinds of interests.
We have heard for years that we're trying to get away from our dependence on oil, that we don't want to have all our vehicles pumped with oil and everything else. And we're not any closer to anything. Why?
Well, I think that's true and not true. I mean, first of all, you know, one of the basic rules of economics is when you have a mass of capital in any industry, it takes an enormous amount to shift. So if you take the automobile industry globally, but I'll just do the United States because more people are familiar with that, it became a more and more inverted industry over time. And it began to believe in what was called planned obsolescence, meaning let's build a car that we know will fall apart in 7 years, so you got to buy another car again. Okay? And that thinking of using the consumer rather than serving the consumer took over Detroit. And it ended up with the bankruptcy of General Motors, bankruptcy of Chrysler, and the near bankruptcy of Ford, who was able to escape clear of it. Now, coming out of that bankruptcy, and GM today is run by a woman named Mary Barra, GM realized, okay, the world is changing, and what we have to do is decide what's the vehicle of the future, not what makes us the most money today, and how do we get there? So Toyota proved that was true with the Prius a decade ago, right? No one thought the Prius was a viable, it was going to be like some kind of an oddity. And now, of course, hybrid vehicles are becoming the norm.
Sure.
And by the way, electric vehicles are going to replace hybrid ones, by and large. Now, that change in thinking happened because consumers wanted it, but it also happened because the concentration of capital behind General Motors, Ford, and all the other manufacturers changed. And that concentration of capital weakened enough for certain companies that previously could never had a chance to get started. Tesla would be the best example. NIO over in China would be another example. And as a result, these companies began to prove that there was a demand. For example, iDrive, a hydrogen-powered electric car. Now, the only place in America you can get those are in California. I've been driving it for 2.5 years. My car refills with hydrogen, and there's already 36 38 stations in California. I can refill the whole car in about 4 minutes.
What's it cost you?
Well, that's the best part. It only costs me $349 a month, and the hydrogen is free.
The hydrogen is free? You mean your car payment is that?
Yep. The car payment comes with free hydrogen.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and in the state of California, this is a better one for your listeners. When you buy one, when you lease one or buy one, the state of California gives you a $5,000 rebate because it's a clean energy vehicle.
So you get a check and for five grand or use it to apply to the car or whatever you want.
Well, you drive off the lot, you get a check for $5,000 in the mail, and the car costs $4,500 down on a 3-year lease at $349 a month.
Not a bad deal.
So, they're giving it away, right? Now, why is Toyota doing that? Now, the same company that pioneered Prius, why are they doing such a great deal? And the answer is because they've discovered that hydrogen is a more effective way to fuel a vehicle than an electric battery. So my car is electric. There's no internal combustion engine. But the electricity comes from a fuel cell rather than from a battery.
And how long will that last before you have to fill it up?
285 miles, roughly.
Well, that's not bad.
Huh?
And they've got them all over the country, so you can't get stuck somewhere?
No, only the state of California. You know, Toyota was an experiment they did in Japan 4 years
okay.
ago.
All right.
It worked in Japan. They said, okay, let's try it on the Americans, just like they did the Prius.
So you don't want to go around the country with this car?
Well, you can't yet because you can't get hydrogen all over the country.
Right.
You can get it in spots, but you will see in a fairly short period of time that more and more states will be permitting it and encouraging it. I'll give you an example. In the country of Germany, which is much further along in the hydrogen economy than we are, and the hydrogen economy is a catchphrase that means this is the fuel that replaces fossil fuel. So if I use hydrogen in a fuel cell in California, I can power the electrical grid. If I use hydrogen in my car, I can power transportation. There was a contest, Long Beach, L.A. Harbor, one of the busiest harbors in the world. The air is so bad, they had to come up with a way to get the trucks in and out without fouling the air, so they wanted to ban internal combustion fossil fuel. They did a contest. See who can build us an electric truck, a freighter, okay, an 18-wheeler. Toyota won overwhelmingly because they took two of the fuel cells in my little car, put them together, and that's how they got the freighter. So they won the contest, and they won all these. I think they've already got something like the first 17 under order, and there's another 34 behind that. So, and they will continue to build now freight trucks, which you'll see on the open highways, running on hydrogen. In Germany, which I started to say is further ahead in the hydrogen economy than we are, they're now running locomotives using fuel cells.
And buses.
Oh, buses. I mean, now I'm going to quote Al Gore here because I don't want to throw a statistic out that I haven't personally researched. So if it's a wrong statistic, blame Al Gore.
Blame him. All right.
What Gore said last week ago Friday was that half the buses in major urban cities will be non-fossil fuel within 5 years. That's a huge number if it's true.
That's huge, but I believe that'll happen.
It could. And again, I it's not my statistics. I hope he's right, but that's where I got it from Gore. When he was being interviewed.
Let's take some calls for you. Let's go to the Dana in New Britain, Connecticut, to get us going east of the Rockies. Hi, Dana. Go ahead.
Oh, how's it going?
Okay.
Thanks for my call. My question was, I know in the Bible they have a thing about Isaac and Ishmael, but my question with Iran and its antipathy with Israel, I know the Persians come from the Elamites and the Medes, so they're not really like Arabs. But, you know, I'm just wondering, like, why, you know, where's this all come from? Because when I read the Bible, you know, it seems like the Old Testament, and I have a Jewish background, it seems like there is a tribal supremacist, racist attitude, you know, in Deuteronomy that God commands, kill the Amalekites, I'll set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, you know, and where's this all come from, you know? And then in the Talmud, it's got kill the best of the Goyim and the Shiksas, and, you know, I mean, so I can't think of another state that could bomb, you know, a U.S. ship like the USS Liberty and get away with it other than Israel. So, you know, that's my question. Thank you.
Well, I think the question's about, first of all, the violence in the Old Testament. And, you know, in the Old Testament, which is a primitive work, right? It comes from in Talmudic times, literally. I mean, you know, in the love of the Israelis and the Jewish population for the written word, as is evidenced by the Talmud as their central spiritual book, explains why they like to record stuff. Well, when you record stuff from times 2,000 years ago or more, you end up with a whole lot of violence because those were violent, barbarous times, and humans have evolved. You would not want to live in the countries that they were described in that particular set of references. In fact, you could add to your references on the Jewish, basically, when the Jews left Egypt, and it took them 40 years to get there, and they decided to land in the Holy Land, they conquered Canaanites, they conquered everybody in their path, and conquered didn't mean they signed a peace treaty. That meant they slaughtered them, and they replaced them with their own nation, which was eventually headed by King David and got to be a very powerful Middle Eastern kingdom. Now, those days are gone, and the enmity you're referring to in the Bible of all these primitive peoples against each other was part of what you would expect from a more primitive time. For two reasons, we can't afford that anymore. The first reason being our weapons are too big. In this show earlier, we were talking about the potential of a nuclear exchange because Iran's going to have nuclear weapons. Israel's already got them. The Saudis are on their way. North Korea's got them, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So, and we referenced the fact that Pakistan and India didn't go to nuclear war just a couple of weeks ago because they realized it was too crazy. So when your weapons are as deadly as our current weapon systems are, you can't afford to be that barbarous and that foolish and that knee-jerk. You got to be a little more thoughtful. And so that's why I think you have a hard time interpreting current day realities in terms of ancient time enmities. Now, the enmities are real, though. I mean, the fact is the Shia do believe that the Sunnis killed their prophet. And the Sunnis do believe that the Shia should be annihilated. And they've been fighting this battle for 1,000 years, whenever one of them had to live under the other.
Yet if you put them side by side, you'd never know who was who.
That's, in fact, that they've done a very good job of living side by side for a millennia. Okay, so it's not that they can't do it; it's just you can't force one of them to bend, if you will, to the knee of the other. You follow me? You can't have one be the conqueror and one the conquered, which was the case for the Shia for most of the last 1,000 years. So now that the Shia revival is occurring, which is why I quoted that book, you have a situation where the Iranians, as the representatives of the Shia, are becoming the dominant regional player. And whereas the Saudis got very fat and rich on oil, the Iranians had to kind of scratch it out. And the Iranians, of course, since you referenced the word Persian, I'm glad you did, most people don't realize that Iran is Persia.
That's right.
And Persia has this 4,000-year history, as you know, a very unbelievably interesting history, and a very violent history, I might add.
Boy, the Shah sure screwed that up, didn't he?
Well, and we screwed it up with the Shah, if you think about it.
Yeah, well, of course.
I mean, we basically have engineered any number of crazy things, and what we did with the Shah would rank right up there with five of the dumbest things of all time, because we got Khomeini as a result.
That's right.
So, I mean, it's not an accident when things go wrong if you do something profoundly stupid on a powder keg. Like, how many of us listening to this call tonight would be willing to throw a bottle of nitroglycerin around the room and hope nobody missed or it didn't explode?
Not me.
Nobody. Because it doesn't make any sense. You got nitroglycerin, you're very careful. Can you use it? Yes, but you got to be very, very, very gentle. And that's the same thing with the Middle East. The Middle East cannot be dealt with a sledgehammer. It requires a scalpel. And as you know, a scalpel in the hands of a surgeon can save a life. In the hands of a murderer, it can kill. So even a scalpel, so a fine pointed instrument, has to be carefully managed in order to get the result you want.
What happened in Cuba with Batista? Why would we support a guy like that? And then Castro comes in, and of course, look what happened. He turned to the Soviets.
It's a tragic comedy. I mean, there's actually parts of it that are downright humorous. We didn't realize that when Fidel Castro, you know, the first thing Castro did after he was successful in the revolution is he flew to the United States.
He came to us.
He came to us and said, I want to be your buddy. I'm only 9 miles away. And they wouldn't see him. They said, uh-oh.
You're a revolutionary. Get out of here.
You're a revolutionary. Get out of here. And they decided that they would crush him rather than embrace him. I would say that would go down as one of the five dumbest mistakes in American history. So what did we do? Well, we set ourselves up for all these years of pain and suffering. We've set ourselves up for internal political destabilization. Just look at the state of Florida. We set ourselves up for a current situation which is completely untenable. And we created a monster, so to speak, in that Cuba had to then use its limited resources, which were human, in order to get power over its Central American neighbors. And so you have people like the Cubans supporting the Venezuelans when they were getting crazier and crazier. And you have Cubans supporting other regimes that are unacceptable. So what happened? Obama opens up Cuba. And Raul Castro says, okay, we're going to allow the internet. I was in Cuba a few months ago, and there are people in most of the main town squares on the internet now, completely unrestricted.
Well, aren't we slamming the door on Cuba again, though?
Yeah, we are. And we're actually doing that. And it's very foolish for a whole bunch of reasons. One, it won't work. In other words, it's not going to collapse Cuba. That's obvious. Two, it will cause them more pain, but it won't stop what they're doing. Three, it turns somebody who wanted to become our friend back into an enemy.
That's right. Never makes sense. Exactly.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So if you're going to do something for geopolitical reasons and you really have a prize to win, okay, take a risk to win. It's like any other game. But if you don't know what you're going to win and you haven't got a strategy for getting there, for God's sakes, don't go beat the hornet's nest. You're going to get stung. And that happens to us repeatedly in the U.S. And I think sometimes, because we're well-intentioned and sometimes we're more interested in empire.
Let's go to Robert in Brooklyn, New York, before the break. Go ahead, Robert. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of points. You have mentioned, it's interesting, faith-based about people who believe that the creation was 6,000 years old, and so I wanted to point that, according to my tradition, Orthodox Judaism, you know, we believe that the earth is almost 6,000 years old, and yet there was a famous rabbi who mentioned that the universe is, 15 billion years old. So there's no contradiction, because you could say it was created in a mature state. So Adam and Eve, they weren't created as children. They were created in the mature state of development. And the earth itself was created in mature development. So it doesn't necessarily even preclude evolution in the sense that it was as if the planet had evolved, even though it didn't actually go that route until it sort of jumped to a certain point. You know, that was one point I just wanted to mention. And the other point I just wanted to touch on is, you know, there was a caller before. He seemed to be a little bit anti-Semitic, and
yet he said he was an Israeli.
I don't know. Sometimes there's self-hating people also, but all I could say is, you know, New York, I know there's been an increase in anti-Semitic.
Yeah, that's growing, sadly. That's growing. That's true. We're going to be back in a moment to take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, if you've got a dog, you're going to love the next couple hours. Dog is love. Why and how your dog loves you. Kind of a different twist, but you're really going to enjoy it. If you don't have a dog, you're still going to like the part of the show. So we're going to come back and take final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our final segment with Ronaldo Brutoco. How am I doing on your last name, Ronaldo? Pretty close?
Close, very close. Brutico.
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 Is that Italian?
It's Italian, yeah. It was Bruto Ciao many years ago.
Interesting. Before
we go to the call, I would love to respond to that last caller.
Okay.
Can I?
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, two things. He was talking about whether or not basically, the planet goes more than 6,000 years back. And as you know, that can be a pretty contentious subject with a lot of people. I'd love to share with you a really great story that comes out of the Scopes monkey trial.
Right.
You may recall in the Scopes monkey trial, William Jennings Bryan was pleading the case of Adam and Eve in a Garden of Paradise. Mm-hmm. It would be illegal to teach in Tennessee the idea of the theory of evolution. Clarence Darrow was defending the concept of evolution. By the way, Darrow lost that case, but won in the court of public opinion.
Right.
And what happened with this case, it was so contentious, it was so divisive, it was like ringing up the Civil War because it was about people's view of their religion. And so a very famous Jesuit priest named Teilhard de Chardin wrote an incredible observation about that contest. And he said, you know, it doesn't really matter whether you think there was a Garden of Eden or you think that people evolved. We all agree humans are here now. Why don't we start from that perspective? Instead of fighting about what may or may not have occurred, it doesn't really have relevance to today. So how shall we live now is the question. And let's heal that injury by saying, we are humans, however we got here. Now what do we want to do together as humans? And by the way, Chardin was actually silenced by the Pope initially because he was viewed to be as too radical. And it turned out that the court of history, he won the battle. I share that with people because if you get all wrapped up in your knickers on whether the planet's 6,000 years or not, it becomes a religious conversation, just like the flat earth theory or not. And religious conversations don't really help us if we're trying to come up with scientific conclusions. So if you want to know how old a rock is, use carbon dating. Don't look it up in the Talmud. Nothing personal to the Talmud.
Well, there's no question to me this planet is 4.5 billion years old, not 6,000.
That would be the evidence. You're just talking evidence now, George.
Exactly.
You're just talking facts.
Yeah, just facts. That's all I need.
Just facts.
Carlos.
So I share that because I think it's really important. And I also wanted to share one other thing, which I think is really important. And he was talking about the rise of anti-Semitism in New York. Well, let's get real. Anti-Semitism is rising all over this country and, frankly, even faster in Europe. And I think one of the reasons.
It's very sad.
It's very sad, and I blame Bibi Netanyahu for a big part of it.
Really? Why?
Absolutely. Because in Bibi's thirst for power over such a long period of time, he has been willing to make alliance after alliance that are not in the interest of the Jewish people. Look at what he's doing even with the Saudis, frankly. Look at what he's doing to try and cobble together his next, which he's not going to make it, I don't think, the cabinet. Okay, why is he fighting so hard to stay in power? Because he's about to be indicted. So it's not because he's a noble view of the Israeli state. And what I think what should happen is that Israel should be the neutral broker, the banker, if you will, the Switzerland of the Middle East, and they ought to have clients on both sides of the aisle, Sunni and Shia. Why get caught in a war? Mm-hmm. That the Saudis talked Benjamin Netanyahu into starting with Iran by getting the Americans to pull out of the Iran deal. How crazy is that?
Until they solve the Palestinian issue, there'll never be peace out in that region.
Well, the Palestinian issue brings up the heart of why I am concerned. And so, as you know, when Bibi just ran for re-election unsuccessfully, he pledged he would take over all the West Bank territories.
Which is not what the Palestinians want to hear.
Well, not only that, but that would be reversing all of the political and historical views of the American governments, including the current one, back for 50, 60 years.
True.
Okay, so what he's doing is he's violating American foreign policy for a vainglorious attempt to get himself reelected. It didn't even work.
And wasn't there Camp David
accord? The head of the army, because they realized that their military risk is greater under Netanyahu than it would be putting a general in charge.
That's right.
By the way, that's shared. All the security forces in Israel have been fed up with Netanyahu for years. So in an attempt to cling to power, Bibi has subjected the Israeli people to a rise in revulsion. And there are a lot of other reasons for anti-Semitism, and I'm not blaming Benjamin Netanyahu all by himself. But what I am saying is, if you are Jewish, what you want to do is hold up the peacemakers in your midst, and you will find peace. You remember that old Gandhi quote? If you believe in the Old Testament, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, we will all end up toothless and blind.
How right he was.
How right he was. So, again, it's not solely in Netanyahu, so don't take me blaming everything. No, there's a terrible illness of the land about the way anti-Semitism has grown. And by the way, there's a terrible illness in the land in the way that people have gotten very jingoistic and I think racist in a lot of ways. And I think it shows up in all kinds of different ways. And it'd be a great conversation to have longer. But I do believe that and I have a very long history of association with the Jewish state, just to let you know, and with basically all of my partners, virtually all of them, for the last 40 years of 50 years have been Jewish. So it's not like I'm saying this as a Christian looking down on Jews, the exact opposite. What I'm hoping for is I can create, help to create with my Jewish brothers and sisters a more peaceful world, because I don't believe anti-Semitism has any place anywhere in the world, and we need to work on it together. And I think that any Israeli leader like Netanyahu, who's rejected by his own military, by his own Secret Service, by his own Shin Bet, all those people, can't keep trying to create controversy in the name of the Jewish state when it's really the name of Bibi Netanyahu. I hope he fails in forming the cabinet. I think he will fail. And I think that Gantz, who's not exactly a radical, he's a former head of the Israeli military, will form a cabinet, and they will now start to work on a meaningful solution to the Palestinian question. Because remember, the challenge here is if there is no Palestinian state, then Israel has to let Arabs vote inside of Israel, and that would be the end of the Jewish state.
That's an interesting take. Let's go to Carlos in San Francisco. Go ahead, Carlos.
Good evening, good morning to you, Mr. Norrie, and your guest, Mr. Burdico. As I was explaining to your screener and trying to formulate my question, I'm really unclear as far as the geopolitical as a geopolitical strategy with regards to what I understand about the petrodollar. And I wanted to ask your guest if he could clarify the petrodollar as a type of military foreign policy to ensure or contribute in some way to peace in the region. And if we go, you know, Middle East oil free, how does the petrodollar retain any value from a type of geopolitical peace in the region?
Okay, explain a little bit of that, Ronaldo, because that's what got Saddam Hussein in hot water.
Yeah. Okay. When you use the term, I'm sorry, I didn't get your first name.
Carlos is his name.
Carlos. Sorry, Carlos. So, Carlos, when you use the term petrodollar, what you mean, I think, and I'm just checking to see if this is true, the amount of money that gets created in dollars from the sale of oil. Is that what you mean by petrodollars?
Well, that's one understanding that I've deduced from the content that I've availed myself to. Another iteration of what I understand is that the U.S. currency, that whatever oil is produced or whatever oil is the commodity of oil within the region, within trading partners of OPEC, that it's tied to the value of the U.S. currency as opposed to other currencies.
Right.
And so,
let me tie those together for you. Okay.
A few minutes to go. Go ahead, Ronaldo.
So the petrodollar is generally refers to all the dollars that are made from the sale of oil, which up until this time have always been done in U.S. denominated exchange, meaning dollars. So when you buy or sell oil in the world up until now, you've done it in dollars. And that's one of the reasons, because we are what's called the reserve currency of the planet, meaning we're the backstop for every other currency. Okay, and when you are the reserve currency, you can print as much debt as you want, and nobody can take you down because you own the bank, so to speak, which is why we can have right now, today, 200% of GDP in debt, which is astronomically high, higher than it was at the end of World War II, if you can believe it. In fact, higher than it was as a percentage of GDP than at the end of the Revolutionary War in the 1700s. What you're talking about, though, is a really important issue, because what's starting to happen is a number of countries are now trading oil in non-dollar denominated transactions. So you can buy Chinese oil with Iranian dollars. You can buy Iranian oil with Chinese yuan or renminbi. And what's happening is there's a strong movement globally now, unfortunately, to take the U.S. down by replacing us as a reserve currency with a combination of currencies. And that will happen if we continue on the current course. Whether or not the petrodollar is tied to petroleum, which is not where the real problem is, the problem is that the dollar is the reserve currency, and that is in jeopardy. And in fact, current administration policies are pushing us further towards that jeopardy, to the point where if we are not the reserve currency, our debt levels will be unsustainable.
Let's go to Mimi in Midland, Texas now. Hi, Mimi. Welcome to the program.
Hi, George. How are you?
Great. I hope you are, too.
Well, I'm good, but I've been here in the Permian Basin, and Midland is the Permian Basin.
There you are.
Midland, Odessa.
52 years. I've been through four booms and busts, and I can tell you that the oil industry is not what it appears to the rest of the world. And this time, I'm extremely worried. We're touting this that we're number one now, but the related industries are laying people off. The cheapest housing is about $360,000. Teachers have left in droves. We're 40 short in firemen, 50 short in policemen, and we're just not prepared at all for what's coming. But basically, the oil industry is controlled by about a dozen oligarchs, and they do control it. And I promise you, they have no intention of letting alternative energies take over.
What do you think of that, Ronaldo?
Well, it's no longer their choice. By the way, I'm very familiar with Midland and Odessa. I actually developed a cable project there many, many years ago, back in the 70s. Actually, yeah, late 70s. And my point would be to your caller, Mimi, that the interesting thing that happened with Shell recently is they acquired a German company called Sonnen. And the reason it's interesting is because Sonnen is the number one manufacturer of control software for renewable energy systems. And they did it because they're realizing that they have to change their belief that the world will run continually on oil. It simply won't and can't. In fact, an exercise I would urge you to do, if you look at the balance sheets of the six major oil companies in the world, you will find that at least half of their proven reserves would cost them more than $45 to pump per barrel, which means they're not economic. Or another way of saying that is you're going to see a balance sheet readjustment in all the major oil companies driving those balance sheets down, which in turn is going to drive their stock prices down. I don't know if you're aware of it, but Exxon just today was downgraded to $1.80 to $67 a share because it said third quarter profits aren't going to be as high because the Saudi thing got fixed.
Sure. They didn't want it fixed.
Yeah, and oil's $52 a barrel, West Texas Intermediate, which is based in Midland, Odessa, as you know. That's where WTI oil is.
I would have thought it would have hit $100 a barrel after the attack on those oil fields.
And it didn't. It never went above 62, and it's down at 52 today. Okay. Now, the point being, there was a time when we ran on petroleum and there was no alternative. And now the reality is the exact opposite. We are out of time, and there is no alternative. I saw a great little piece on the news this morning of a farmer in Georgia whose corn had completely shriveled up because there's been a one-month drought in the southeast.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, and what he said is, when he was asked, well, what do you think you're going to do? He said, well, this is the first time in 34 years of farming that this has ever happened. He says, well, what do you think is the cause? He says, I'm beginning to think there's something to this climate change stuff. And there is something to this climate change stuff. And so we are increasingly aware of it. And as we get aware of it, what we need to do is to focus on how to make this transition and minimize the damage so that people in Midland, Odessa can afford firemen, can afford policemen. In other words, we have to build the equivalent of a reconstruction program like we did after World War II. We had all those people coming back from the war, and we had to figure out how to re-employ them in the civilian economy. We can do the same thing again. And in fact, if we do, the economy will boom in the U.S., because we'll have taken care of our people, and we have a consumption economy. So when the people do well and they have money to spend, the economy does well.
We as a nation do very well if that happens.
And we as a nation do very well. And that's what we should be heading for. And let's be optimists. You know, one of the reasons I keep pushing the Optimist Daily is we are completely apolitical. You'll never see a political story of any stripe in the Optimist Daily, because we don't think getting involved in the confrontation of political ideologies is helpful to finding creative solutions to the future.
Give us that website again for the free newsletters.
OptimistDaily.com.
OptimistDaily.com. Great. Ronaldo, thanks for being on the program. Really appreciate it. We're going to come back in just a moment. If you have a dog, definitely sit by your radio. If you love animals, and I sure hope you do, this is a couple hours you're going to really, really enjoy. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.